Steve Almond has ostensibly written about writing, a craft book, in his latest work, Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories. It's a book about writing, sure, but it's also more than just that. And even as a book about writing, it's still classic Steve Almond, thoughtful, intelligent, eloquent, honest, vulnerable, funny, and even emotional. This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow is a book I now find to be indispensable for what it offers to us about, yes, constructing stories. But we also learn about Almond's own struggles as a writer. Even with his many publications, he must still manage writer's block and the conundrum that is the writing life. He offers us information about plot and character and reliable narrator, among other important elements. But it's also very much a book about being a reader, but also a teacher, a parent. He shares what he's learned about how, quote, grace arrives only when you're standing in the truth. I spoke to author Steve Almond about his book, Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow. Hey, I'm so excited about this book.
Thank you. God, did I spend many years compiling everything I thought could be of use to other fellow travelers and keyboard strugglers. So I'm just excited to get it into the world. I feel like it's, you know, the way I work is, you know, from having read, being one of the six people who read the Stoner book, I tend to conceive of books that have no discernible audience. You know, I'll write a social thriller about the immigration situation, or I'll write an obscure, you know, sort of memoir about a totally obscure novel. But finally, I have a book that I feel like has an intended audience. I'm really excited about that.
Steve, you've published 11 books.
This is 12, I think.
This is 12. But this is the first one on craft, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, actually, even this answer in typical Almond style is overdetermined and, you know, convoluted. I actually publish these crazy DIY books, you know, like after I had a couple of books out with Random House and I'd been to the top of the penthouse in Midtown Manhattan and had the experience of kind of being called up to the big leagues and, you know, batting about 152 and disappointing everyone because I'm not a big commercial author. I think my appeals are much more slender, but I sort of was like, okay, I had that experience. Now I want to have the opposite experience. I want to put books into the world just that are little weird books that I just print up. I work with an artist friend of mine and they're totally DIY. Mm-hmm. And so the first one of those that I did was this book called This Won't Take But a Minute, Honey, which is actually a lot of it is I smuggled into Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow in the form of the frequently asked questions at the end.
Yes.
Yeah. So that, you know, that book, along with Letters from People Who Hate Me and Bad Poetry and a few other weirdo books I did, were like these little, I don't know, they were just these DIY books because I love the book as a cultural artifact. So I will say that it's sort of my first craft book, but already there are, I don't know, several thousand people who just bought This Won't Take But a Minute, Honey from me in person out of my backpack for cash, like a drug deal, because I loved that experience of wanting to put some language to everything that we struggle with when we come to a creative endeavor, in this case, creative writing. But I think it applies to any time you're, you know, trying to create something, you're making a whole bunch of decisions, usually on your own, if you're a writer, and you're choked with doubt and anxiety the whole time. And I felt like I've lived that experience for many years and it's lonely and it's confusing. And I wanted to be able to, you know, sort of throw the rope of love out to other people who are in that struggle.
I want to talk about this anecdote that you share at the very beginning of the book about being in China.
Yeah.
That was such a moving start to this book, and we were off to the races, but what is the holy jolt?
Yeah, I mean, the holy jolt is the feeling in that room in China through five layers of translation of everybody being held in the same story, everybody listening to that young woman tell us about that red bicycle with the silver handlebars that she dreamed about riding, that she obsessed over, and the feeling of power and escape and just the desire to lead a larger life. And like, for everybody to be held in the same story, coming from all over China with all kinds of different agendas, and me coming in my addled state from, you know, Boston, and arriving kind of in almost a psychotic state of disassociation because of all the strangeness of the experience, to have a story that we were all held in which we participated in her yearning, our own version of that desire to reach for the transcendent and the eternal that she was able to capture so beautifully. That is what storytelling does in its essence, is it is just this incredible connector. We feel like, ah, yes, that's my story too. I've got a different, it's not a red bicycle for me. For me, it's a candy bar, or, you know, or a beautiful painting or whatever. But that feeling of trying to sort of recognize that we, as a species, the thing that holds us together is that we, underneath all the defenses, we have the same yearnings, the same fears, the same desires, and to just be like less alone in it, less alone in the crazy.
I'm looking at how you structured the book, and the first part is on demystifying the craft. But I think of this book now as being for everyone, and not just for those who want to read a book about writing. So for one thing, as you've kind of said just now, you believe that, you say, every single person on earth is a storyteller. For another thing, you write about the way that pursuing something like writing calls for, you say, patience, forgiveness, and courage. Those are things we can all use all day, every day. Not just when we're talking about writing. Do you see this too, the ways that this book is really for a much wider audience? You know, the craft books are in a certain section of the bookstore, right, and there are certain people who will migrate to that section. And I feel like I need to go into bookstores and move this book into other sections for everybody to find.
Yes, please do.
I'll do that.
I mean, you know, that connects to what, the way I wanted to, I spent months trying to figure out the way to introduce this book, because it's going to be marketed as a craft book in the same way maybe Candy Freak gets marketed as a food book or something. But, you know, I like books that are hard to categorize in that way, whose modes of storytelling and concerns feel more universal. For me, the handshake, the way to introduce the book, was to try to say, look, what distinguishes us from any other species on Earth and maybe in the entire universe? We are a storytelling species. We have these big, complicated brains and all this bad data that we're going to die. People around us are going to die. We're vulnerable to illness, to loss, to confusion and bewilderment. And we have all these urges that are so powerful. We feel guilty about them, and we want to heal the world, but we know that it's broken, and we want to heal ourselves, but we know we're broken. Like, that's hard to carry, all that stuff. And the way that we deal with that, in part, is by telling stories and trying to understand the meaning of what we're living through. And I feel like that's a universal experience. And I sort of closed my eyes when I finally realized, no, it's that red bicycle under the white moon. That's what I mean. That's the holy jolt that got me to, I sort of discovered that's what the introduction needs to be, to try to say, yeah, okay, I'm talking about writing. I hope there's a section about craft that demystifies it and puts some language to common struggles and even technical aspects of writing. But most of the book, as you know, is really like, where do stories come from? What is inspiration in our lives? And what do we deal with? What are the inhibitions and anxieties, the evil voices that stop us from creating, that turn off our creativity, that turn off that freedom to associate, and that a desire really to tell the truth about what we've lived through. And so I guess that's exactly what my hope is. And you can't, like, you know, I don't have any control over anything, really. That's maybe another lesson in the book. But I wanted to write something that felt more like, this is what the creative process is like. This is its joys and pleasures, and this is its sorrows and struggles. And That's what I'm after here. Yes, I want to tell you about plot, how to manage chronology, and all the stuff I've been yammering at students for, you know, 3.5 decades. But mostly, I want to write as somebody who struggled to find stories that will help me live through, you know, the most difficult times of my experience, and also celebrate the moments that I feel like I never want to forget, and I want to convey them. I want to throw that love out into the world and see whether there are people who will catch it.
I've read a lot of books about writing. This is a very different book, I have to say. And one of the things that sets it apart is just how honest you are and how vulnerable you are about your own struggles as a writer. And you share that you're not great at plot in your writing. You say it's, quote, the most intricate and elusive part of storytelling. I agree with you.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, why is plot so hard? And then I thought, no, people need to read the book. Then I was looking at how a couple of things. You've written an entire book about the John Williams novel Stoner. I was so happy to read the sections in this new book about this novel. And then I was looking at the section on, in part two, on source materials about obsessions. You talk about varieties of obsession and the necessity of these as an engine of literature. And you also say that, quote, the most exciting part of an obsession is the part you don't understand. So I kept looking at this and thinking, Stoner gives you access into understanding plot. And Stoner was a very particular kind of an obsession for you. So I just love reading the book, going through the book, and sort of making these connections and thinking about the ways obsessions are, you know, such a positive, they can be a very positive thing.
They are. We are an obsessive species. You know, when we're babies and small children, what we care about and the way that we care is not containable. It's not controlled. We hunger obsessively. We mourn obsessively. We yearn obsessively. And I think we're socialized out of it. It's disruptive. It's inconvenient. Our parents and teachers and pastors and whoever don't want us to feel too much because they know that that's been painful for them. So they, you know, they don't want us to interrupt class. You know, so they they send the message, you know, stop obsessing, stop caring so much about that particular thing. And we eventually get it and we get socialized. But that doesn't make the obsession go away. I would argue that it springloads it with the force of suppression. And for me, to make another connection in the book, how I've gotten out of writer's block, you know, when we talked earlier about Candy Freak, which is a book about my obsession with candy. And, you know, that was a book that allowed me to write my way out of a terrible writer's block because I was trying to write a big historical novel that was far beyond my abilities. And I failed at that miserably after 3 years of 850 pages of hacking away. And I immediately spiraled into a depression. And the only thing that would get me out of bed was a piece of chocolate, a good piece of chocolate. And then I realized, hold on a second, there are factories where they make this stuff. How am I going to get myself inside one of those? And the moment I got into a chocolate factory, I suddenly, the depression just evaporated. And I was overtaken by absolute enthrallment with what was around me, the conveyor belt with the shiny little marshmallow bunnies that were being washed with a curtain of chocolate, and the floors covered in Necco wafers like a giant, beautiful Kandinsky painting, right? And the elevators that smelled like Halloween. I mean, I was just suddenly paying attention to the world again. And that was, to me, intuitively, even though I thought I was writing this silly book and I was being a sellout or whatever, was actually how the depression lifted. Was I plugged into the power of my own obsession rather than hiding it as something shameful. I said, this is actually the engine of the next thing I'm going to write. And that pattern, I'm sorry to say, has prevailed throughout my career. I usually fail at a novel, and then I find, I stop asking, what should I be writing? That isn't working. And I ask a much more useful question. What do I want to write? What will get me to the keyboard? What will get me more interested in the story I'm telling than whether I'm telling it well?
I love this idea. Well, you mentioned writer's block. Let's talk about writer's block.
Okay.
You say we should stop treating writer's block like a binary. And you say that it can be a symptom of progress. I've talked to a lot of writers. Some have said there's no such thing as writer's block. Or they'll call it something else, but it sounds a lot like writer's block. But what is what is writer's block?
I think the way I define it, so let me start with an analogy. Like, we're now realizing that people's brains are really like the last frontier. I think there's like a universe in every brain, and they're so particular and so complex and so inimitable, individual. And so we try to sort of create a spectrum of neurotypical brains and neurodiverse brains, but it keeps shifting around. It's blurry. And that's my feeling about writer's block, is that it's the name we give for a very acute feeling that your doubt has overtaken your capacity to make decisions at the keyboard, that your lack of faith in a good possibility of your creative attention being focused on telling some story or another has become, you know, shut you down because you just don't have faith that you'll be able to accomplish anything. And it can be, in my case, it was accompanied by a sort of broader clinical depression, right? Mm-hmm. And that's quite serious. But if we really look at it, what it is a moment where we lose faith in our capacity to tell a story that's worth listening to. And we lose focus on the thing that's giving us energy, that obsession we're trying to pursue, that story, that character who we're trying to see into their appointed danger and maybe through it. And we start, you know, I think doubting ourselves and doubting our decisions, and we get inhibited and self-conscious. And that's what writer's block is. I believe that when I was writing that novel that was such a spectacular failure, even though my fingers were moving and I was typing all those words and I was pushing characters around through 850 pages, I think in a certain way I was blocked. I think when I'm rewriting the same paragraph for the 56th time because I haven't figured out the next beat in the story, I think that's a form of a block. So rather than defining it as like the black plague of writing that we should be silent about and go into quarantine, we should just accept that those inhibitory, you know, those inhibited impulses are kind of just the price of doing business, and that you're always doing battle with them in one way or another. And that your job isn't to defeat them or try to control them or willpower your way through them or even deny that they exist, but somehow find the patience and courage and forgiveness to say, okay, this is something I'm going to have to manage. I'm not going to be able to make it go away, but I need to be able to identify, and to the extent that I can, allow myself to get more interested in the story I'm trying to tell than whether I'm doing it well or not, whether I'm impressing the reader, whatever the ego need is that distracts us from our character's struggles. And that's, you know, and I can identify that. I think I have clear language and my thinking about it is clear, and I still get blocked constantly.
Steve, the man at the top of the stairs, the section called The Man at the Top of the Stairs, on rendering the inner life. Again, another section of the book, not just for people who want to read about craft and about writing, but for readers, for people who love great stories. You say that it is the mission of all art, particularly literary art, to engage with the inner life. The problem is that the larger story of our species is it wages a sustained assault on our inner life. I just found this section so important and riveting. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about this part of the book.
Yeah, it's kind of devastating because we all walk around with this very, very complicated private experience, the story of who we know ourselves to be, what we're struggling about, what we're worrying about, what we're mourning, and what we're confused about most of all. And we mostly hide it from view. And now into our lives have come because of our big brains that are constantly trying to understand our experience, but also trying to hide from the painful, confusing parts of it. We now have these devices that allow us to constantly distract ourselves from what's happening in the inner life. In fact, part of their trick is that they get us to put on display a version of our lives, on social media primarily, that is a kind of ad campaign for how well everything is going, which is complete nonsense. It's just not true. You know, the beautiful sunset happened and the family was all smiling. And then 5 seconds after the photo was taken, all hell broke loose. And the resentments and doubts and rivalries and insecurities took over. And we all know that. We all know that we're can I say bullshitting?
Yeah.
You know, we all know that we're kind of bullshitting, but we all consent to it and we all participate in it. And therefore, we feel even more alone with our inner life. And the real state of struggle and confusion and disequilibrium that is most frequently our experience. And that's why we go to literature, because in literature and other kinds of storytelling, great films do this and great paintings and great music, they do it in different ways. But what we are finding there is that we're not alone in that distress, in that confusion, in that yearning, in that desire that will never, you know, that will never be consummated. Like, we're all living in that struggle. We're not alone in it. And that's why, in a weird way, I feel closer to the characters in a lot of the books that I read than I do to people very close to me, because I feel like I have access to their inner life in a way that I don't oftentimes when it's a real flesh and blood person and all of our defenses and all of our fronting gets in the way of the real stuff.
So, Steve, we can say bullshit, but we can't say entitlement.
Good.
So, in this section, you discuss this idea of entitlement that we might see in the context of a workshop or a classroom or other contexts. And you write about this, I'm going to say, so bravely. I mean, I feel sometimes like I can't talk about this topic with people. But you wrote about it. It's in this book. So I wonder if you can say a little bit about entitlement. It doesn't have to necessarily be this terrible thing or this terrible indictment of young people or a particular group. It's really something a lot more complicated. And yet, you express it so clearly. I wonder if you can talk about it just a little bit.
Sure. I mean, I think the dyad that I was writing about was entitlement and failure. And the way I think of it is like this. Entitlement is the feeling somehow that your own struggles and problems are the world's fault, and that you're entitled to a certain kind of experience or status or power in the world. And, you know, we're sort of living through the most massive version of that, because the central figure in our culture is this kind of figure of depraved entitlement, right? This sad, you know, what was a sad, unloved boy who's grown into a cruel, destructive man, who just feels in every moment, in every impulse, is expressing the idea that he's entitled to everything. He can grab women by their genitals. He can not pay any of his debts. He can go bankrupt constantly. He can say he won an election. He didn't win, all that. He's just sort of the version of entitlement, baked in with a lot of white supremacy and patriarchal garbage. And the enemy really of entitlement is the idea of becoming conscious of your moral responsibilities in the world, and your emotional and psychological responsibilities in the world, and that what you do has a, you know, affects the rest of the world. And therefore you should step back from your own experience and say, Almond feels a great right to speak about things. Where might that have come from? Oh, let's see. He was born middle class, upper middle class. He's a white male. You know, he's grown up in the suburbs. He had an intact family that was supportive. He's got a lot of things that he did not earn, that he simply was born into. Huh, what's it like for Lorena Sines, the heroine of my novel, All the Secrets of the World? Well, she's born in an undocumented family. She's a woman of color. She needs to remain invisible in many ways because her margin for error is so much smaller. And if I don't come into consciousness about that, that's still fine. I can travel along in my little bubble. I think the job of great novels, in a way, is to tell the truth and get people to face who they are. The central danger And a good piece of writing is self-revelation. And that means if you're a person who enjoys a certain cultural power that you did not earn, but that you simply inherited because of the depraved systems of power, the patriarchal system, the system of white supremacy, colonialism, all the big fancy names we give to artificial systems of power that bestow onto one category of people the power to determine the fate of other people who are born into a different circumstance. Like if we can't recognize that, I think we're sunk as a species. And I think the evidence is sort of staring us in the face. That's the world global view of entitlement. For the artist, you need to recognize that you are not entitled to praise from the reader. You're not entitled even to have them pay attention to your stories. You have to earn that. You have to earn that through your courage and your patience and your sustained attention to the struggle of your characters. And if you do that work, you're absolutely entitled to have, you know, or at least to have the expectation that a reader will stay in your dream. But if you can't see that, if you can't accept that you could make even better decisions that would make the story more honest, more truthful, and therefore more beautiful, then you're never going to go anywhere. You know, you're never going to get anywhere as a creative person, as a writer. And a lot of that is recognizing that failure is a part of the process. When you are entitled as an artist, you cannot accept failure. You view it as something shameful, something to be hidden away, something that's an error in accounting. It's not. The central experience of writing or creating anything is failure. And the moment you start to accept that failure is a part of the process, it's not something being inflicted on you by the world, it's just you needing to pay more careful attention, to accept that there are limits to what you could do, to the set of decisions you could make at that particular time in your writing life, without getting into the opera of self-doubt, to just say, oh, okay, there's some room for improvement. I could do even better. I could reach even deeper. If I could get a little bit more mercy in the bow, then the arrow of truth would travel further into the character's real experiences, their inner life. And therefore, the reader would feel a greater sense of identification and emotional and psychological engagement with the story that I'm telling. The rope of love is that much more durable and it travels further. That's all that I'm trying to say, that entitlement is the enemy of artistic progress, and that the acceptance of failure is ultimately, like writer's block, is your ally. You don't make it go away. I'm not advocating that people go out and say, I'm a failure and it's great. It sucks. I've had enough of it in my career to know it sucks. It hurts. It shakes your confidence and your sort of self-belief. But even those moments when, for me anyway, I'm feeling blocked, I've been doing this long enough to say, okay, this is a bad stretch. I'm not going to do much good writing now. I'm too upset. I can't get out of my own head. I'm too needy. Let me just try to set the bar a little bit lower for myself. Let me step back and say, okay, this isn't a great era in my writing life, but it's not the only era, and just sort of hold space for the possibility that sooner or later, I'm going to allow myself to plug into some obsession that will get me back to the keyboard and get me paying attention to the world and trying to love it.
Truth is the arrow, mercy is the bow. I really believe that this is a book for everyone, even for those who don't spend a lot of time writing, but certainly for people who enjoy reading, I think this is a gorgeous, perfect book. It's also very rich with your personal stories and anecdotes. You're very honest about yourself as a dad, as a writer, and the struggles that we've been discussing, as a teacher. And it seems to me that you live out what you assert, and that is that, this is your quote, grace arrives only when you're standing in the truth. The book is so much about family and parenting, the reading life, love, sex, a failure, ego. I read sections of this to my husband. We were howling. You're very funny, Steve Ullman. I also cried through parts of this. I read a description in the advance information about the book where somebody somebody wrote that they were moved to tears. And I said, how can that be? This is a book about writing. We cry when we write, but not when we read about it. But yeah, this book is so rich. It's so multidimensional. I mean, I would even hesitate to just say, oh, it's a book about writing.
Yeah.
It's really so special. It is gorgeous. The title is gorgeous. It's enigmatic. It's kind of perfect. It's beautiful. And then there's so much in this book. It did spur my writing. It did.
Oh, good.
Yeah. It made me go back to favorite stories to reread. It made me go back to Stoner. It made me go back to your book about Stoner. It made me celebrate being a really obsessive person. It's so... This book is miraculous.
Well, listen, I'm happy to just have you talk about the book rather than have me talk about it. It sounds a lot better when you talk about it. But I'll tell you that title, I really, and I'm glad that my publisher didn't fight me on this. My editor, Emily Bell, who's so amazing. I thought I was going to have a big fight with her because the SEO people, you know, those Google searching rank people would
yes.
say, no, we need creative writing in the title because that will convey that it's about creative writing and people, it will show up on the right algorithm. And I was like, no, please don't do this. The title is is my distillation of what I've been trying to say to students and myself for, you know, years and years. It's like, I know it's a bit of a riddle. I know it's a mouthful, but I'm really trying to tell you, you will travel into the truth as far as mercy will get you and no further. And that can be, you know, that's something you can develop over a lifetime. Hopefully you are. You're evolving, becoming less entitled and more sort of forgiving of the world and forgiving of yourself. But that construction, when I found those words to try to explain it to a student in some class or another, it just stuck. And I was like, you know, the sound, like when an arrow goes in, it goes whing, and there's that sort of vibration. And
yes.
It's really struck deep. That's the feeling I had. Finally found the right language to explain what I mean, to distill what I think in its essence about the artistic endeavor. And so I was very much on pins and needles thinking, oh God, they're going to try to make me call it, you know, creative writing or, you know, guide or something like that. And they were, I think, whatever, just brave enough to say, okay, Almond, do you want to call it that? People are going to be a little bit confused, but that's okay. Like, God, I think we do so much condescending to anybody who's picking up a book is somebody who's deeply thoughtful. They're picking up a friggin' book, for God's sakes. They're a little bit patient. If the language excites them, intrigues them, they're not going to throw down the book if they don't immediately understand it. And so I had that feeling. And even the subtitle, a DIY kit for the construction of stories, was my effort to say sort of a throwback to my DIY books. You know, look, this is about the construction of stories. And yes, that applies to writing. In this case, that's my area that I know the most about, mostly as a struggling writer. But it could apply to any kind of creative endeavor, to the construction of any kind of story, whether that's visual art, filmmaking, or music, whatever it is. I view it in the broadest terms as stories, as storytelling. And I wanted, after I wrote about sort of, here are the sources of inspiration, here are the things that hold us back at the keyboard, here's how to try to tell the unbearable story. It felt like I would be cheating the reader or sort of instructing them without really participating myself or putting skin in the game, my own skin, if I didn't share, you know, stories of my own struggle. I didn't want to write, I'm the wise professor who's figured it all out. That's not how it feels for me at the keyboard. It's just the opposite. Every time I face it, I feel like a complete idiot who doesn't know what he's doing and is going to screw it up. And I didn't want to write a book that pretended otherwise.
Grace arrives only when you're standing in the truth. That's the tattoo and the bumper sticker.
All right, good. I'm glad that there's going to be a bumper sticker. I'm sure that lots of people are going to look at that and go, wow, oh, that guy must be a real jerk. How could he say such a thing?
Truth is the arrow, mercy is the bow. Steve Almond, thank you so much for talking to me today. What a thrill. What an honor to get to talk to you about this book.
Yeah, listen, I want you on the publicity team. Good Lord. I wish I'd gotten a blurb from Yvette.
Next time.
Okay.
Steve Almond is the author of Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Write to us at bookpublic@tpr.org. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.